I'm Elizabeth Garnalis with the Colorado Center on Law and Policy, and I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking about sort of the Affordable Care Act and how Medicaid fits, because I think sometimes in every aspect of health care, and certainly in health reform, because it's so rich and there's so much there, that we can sort of get locked into our silo. And so I want to talk about sort of globally how Medicaid fits into the overall Affordable Care Act picture, and then spend a couple minutes at the end talking about states and what opportunities there are for states, and how we might, as members of the healthcare community, move those opportunities. So just, I start every presentation with this, and I'm doing it here today as well. But I think it's really important to think about sort of where Medicaid fits overall in the Affordable Care Act. And so this three-legged stool is the way I think about healthcare reform. The pieces are the individual mandate, which has gotten, you know, an enormous amount of discussion across the country, but the requirement of the individual mandate then means that we must have health insurance reform. Those two pieces work in tandem, because you can't require people to have health insurance unless you reform the health insurance delivery system and require health insurance providers to offer, and you can't have that without that picture without affordability protections, because you can't require people to buy unless they can afford it. And I put that in here because Medicaid then becomes an important piece of the base, the platform upon which the Affordable Care Act is built. We've talked about this in previous presentations, so everybody's in with the individual mandate. We've expanded eligibility. We're streamlining the program and getting rid of categorical eligibility, and we have coverage expansions that really are about children, families, and individuals particularly who haven't traditionally been eligible for entry into this system. This is a slide that I've cribbed from some colleagues in Texas, but I think, again, just as an illustration of how Medicaid is the base for all of this, the Affordable Care Act really rests on the premise that we can get low-income people covered through the Medicaid program. You know, we can talk about this, but Medicaid, of course, has a richer set of benefits traditionally because it is low-income people who don't have the resources to go outside of the program to pay for care on their own. Those are coverage expansions sort of globally. There are also a whole bunch of systems changes that we see coming in Medicaid and across the healthcare system. And so these aren't actually exclusive to the Medicaid program. There's a strong emphasis on prevention, early intervention, avoidable costs, and incentives for bringing people in, getting rid of co-payments, for example, increasing benefits in Medicare and prevention, options for increasing preventive services in the Medicaid program, early intervention being part of that model, and then a whole set of incentives around avoidable costs in the healthcare system as well. There are core care coordination models that are being incentivized, including medical homes, accountable care organizations, and then we've talked a lot about dual eligibles and the emphasis on coordinating care for dual eligibles in the program, and the strong push to encourage the provision of community-based long-term care as opposed to institutionalization, and equalizing those incentives across those two systems. issues for states, managing large increases in enrollment is something that states have been thinking about how they're going to do. I think about Colorado, where we're projecting in a Medicaid program that currently has about 600,000 members, about a 230,000 increase over the next few years. That's a significant increase. And just thinking about systems issues, as you bring all those people in, thinking about provider availability, thinking about basic eligibility determination, and streamlining programs as they come in. And then, you know, you've got a lot of issues and about pent-up demand and how those people are going to access a system that haven't currently had entry, including particularly individuals under 100, single adults under 100% of poverty, who traditionally have been kept out of many states' healthcare public systems. One of the things sort of system-wide, both for public health, but I think about this for community health centers and other sort of on-the-ground fundamental providers of services, is sort of the payer mix and populations that they serve and what it means, for example, to have a much higher emphasis on prevention in our private insurance programs and our public insurance programs. There's an option, for example, to include vaccinations and other baseline preventive care recommendations in the Medicaid program for states. So how does that change the dynamic, or does it at all, between public health and insurance, whether public or private. Here's some other issues: Medicaid expansions, timing of those expansions. We've heard a little bit about how some states are going early to expand eligibility for programs. There's decisions about how rich the benefits package are going to be for new eligibles. Is it going to be the full Medicaid benefit and the social justice model we just heard about? You would think that the answer might be yes, but you can do everything from a full Medicaid benefit to a benchmark plan, and so there's a lot of policy decisions to be made about the integrity of the Medicaid program and what it's actually designed to do and deliver. Medicaid and the exchange, we haven't talked about at all. I'm a very strong proponent of people who care about Medicaid getting involved in the discussion about the exchange, because these systems have got to work together. They're required to work together, but how the exchange is designed, how it interacts with the Medicaid program, how we think about things like transition of care, things as simple as if you have a fee-for-service Medicaid system and you're putting people, as they hit that cliff, whatever the cutoff is for income, into a private health insurance model, how do you make sure that you have continuity of care? Those are decisions that states are largely going to make, and I think state-level people who are working on this have to spend a lot of time and give this very careful thought, because we can design it well or we can design it badly, and I think the consequences of designing it badly are going to play out with those people in that middle group who are shifting back and forth between care models. There's lots of grants and demonstration opportunities. I've just listed some of them. Money has just gone out the door, about $100 million for some of these things listed, and there's more money coming, and there's a big opportunities for public health, but there's big opportunities for everybody here, and I guess the core message I have is there are huge opportunities here. But it's big and complex and confusing and siloed, and there's a lot of things to think about. So can we use this time to design systems that actually work? And then the last is this: are you ready? Just thinking about infrastructure issues. What are the strengths and weaknesses of our current delivery systems in our states? What we talked about: provider capacity and state capacity. There's agency coordination and leadership. Does our Medicaid program work with your Division of Insurance, work with your public health department? IT issues. Colorado's a prime example, but a lot of states have difficulty with their IT systems and eligibility determination. And the exchanges have got to work from an IT perspective, and our Medicaid programs do too. And then, as governors transition in many states and state legislatures change hands, do we have continuity from the good work that's been started in many states about implementation? Are we going to lose ground, or are we going to sort of continue on, or how does that work? So with that, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you to all the speakers for keeping us exactly on time, so that we have now about 15-20 minutes available for discussion. Andy, yes, over there. Can everybody hear?
No.
Maybe we should. Could you come to? Do we have a?
Condition, and I'm wondering how this could influence states in terms of integrating primary care and other kinds of initiatives to try to take advantage of that. That starts next year, I believe.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if that's a demonstration that the states can apply to, or if they
Could you explain it? Can you say what you're about?
So, what will happen here, and I expect it to happen momentarily, HHS will announce this through CMS. And if the state wants to create medical homes for adults with serious mental illness, they can do it for that population alone. For any other population, they have to be working with people who have two chronic conditions. I believe the application will be due by January 1st to HHS, and every state will be eligible, and obviously all of us who work in these fields, and I work in the mental health field, are very interested that the states actually apply for these opportunities so that we begin making progress on creating medical homes. So you can literally look forward to HHS coming out with something in a few days. Yeah.
And there are also opportunities for pediatric medical homes. I mean, there's a long list of projects.
Any other question? By the way, if people can either talk loud or they can come here and use one microphone.
Over there. Yeah, I was curious. I mean, it's obviously very important that states get it right in terms of implementing this law, because 90% of the calls to the states do, and states don't all do things the same way, as we pointed out earlier, particularly in the Medicaid programs. But do we know what are the design elements that you're looking for in terms of the exchange and Medicaid participating in the exchange? I mean, clearly, if it's 133% of poverty or 138%, these are all working people, so their income will go up, their income will go down, they'll be on Medicaid, they'll be in the exchange. You won't be able to predict who's going to be where, so we have to have a much more seamless delivery system than the system we've had for the last 40 years, where Medicaid providers have been over here and the private insurance providers over there. But by and large, the managed care has changed some of that over the years, but that's still down in a way. So we want to do that, but I don't know that anyone necessarily knows what are all, has anybody working on the steps or guidelines for states to follow so that we'll have a good system? Like, one of those things we'll know when it's not working, but rather than make mistakes and learn from those, are there design elements that people are recommending or that have been developed, you know, in the great think tanks or wherever on how to make this work?
I think there's a lot of activity at HHS trying to work these things out, but I'm not on top of it. I mean, the one thing I would say is that one way that these could be a lot more seamless than you may think is that I think an awful lot of the Medicaid managed care plans are talking about, you know, expanding and being involved in exchanges. So people could, they may have more choices, but they might have that same choice.
Is it possible to require private insurers to participate in Medicaid as well, to go the other way? The condition of being on the exchange is that you also...
I suppose you could do that. Maybe you could do that at the state level. I think with all the backlash that this has happened, there's probably a natural limit to all these requirements that insurers have to do this and hospitals have to do things. So I don't know. I kind of think that's, we might have moved past that.
There's a lot that's being written about sort of exchange design. I haven't seen a lot yet, although I think HHS is certainly working on it, on sort of this Medicaid piece. And in fact, you know, in our state, it's sort of been a matter of getting the Medicaid piece on the table and that need for coordination on the table for discussion. I think one of the things that, the only thing I've really seen people start to talk about is there is an option to sort of treat people in the 133% of federal poverty and 200% of poverty differently by designing something that's different, a public, quasi-public program. And so that may be, or I've heard some discussion about that being one place for helping to sort of cushion the blow, so to speak, of that cliff effect as people get 133% of poverty. But I think this is something clearly that's going to get a lot more attention from our national colleagues and people who focus on Medicaid, and that there's going to have to be a lot of work on this. And I think a lot of it's going to devolve to the states to figure out, because every state's still going to have, to some extent, partially unique Medicaid.
Okay, over there, and then.
That 133% guideline, you know, by the history of previous experience with Medicaid, is very troublesome. The question becomes, how frequently is that determined? Somebody gets another job, gets a new job, they violate that guideline, their services are cut off because their health deteriorates, they lose their job, and then they wind up back in the 133%. The history of the CHIP program and the LAMMS program, are such that, you know, originally when Medicaid got into the community care kind of mode, you'd have women who'd initially qualify for the program, but then they'd be reevaluated 6 months later, which is just before they were going to go in to deliver their baby, and find out that they weren't eligible anymore because their income had increased, and then they'd be shunted from the hospital they would have gone to some safety net hospital that's got no medical records. Have people learned from their experience? Is there something built into the program or in the new legislation that will smooth over and ameliorate those problems?
Well, there's a huge change in that, you know, people who got above 133 might have gone on an employer's plan, but they might have been uninsured. Now, I mean, they will have a lot of options within exchanges to stay insured. May not be with the same plan, it might be, but they're not going to lose coverage.
But as soon as their income changes then, they've got to go to another provider, deal with another set of records. This whole concept.
Well, I mean, look, the way that, I mean, there were people who thought we ought to get rid of Medicaid and have everybody in the exchanges on the grounds that there's no country with universal coverage that is a separate program for low-income people. The people who are very strong advocates of Medicaid did not want to lose a lot of the, you know, the law and the regulations and the extensive benefits that are in that program. So they fought, they won that battle. So the bottom of this tier is Medicaid. But it's not, you're not going to extend Medicaid much further. That was a probably major victory for those folks to get it where it is. So there's got to be a cliff someplace. The basic health plan allows it to go a little bit higher, but then you got another cliff. So, I mean, it's.
So that's a problem that's built into the system and nobody has thought of a way to.
And they've done that. Well, part of the scary thing is how captive to politics this all is, because if you come at it with that we want people to enroll in whatever, in something, you can do an annual application, and then you say whatever your income is that month, that's good for the year, that there has to be a no penalty, like we're not going to come back and harass you for an overpayment or whatever if you get more money the next month. Now, of course, that's also open to what people would consider to be, you know, anyone with high bills can, you know, quit their job for a month, but I think it's important that there's a lot of reasons people's income changes. And I don't think that there are a lot of people that go around thinking about, oh, I'm going to quit my job to get medical care. I mean,
People are given that advice.
Right, but I think, like, for example, you can have the whole issue with, like, the DAC, the disabled adult child, where someone is disabled and their parent dies, and then their Social Security goes up, and that, so they're not going to be able to go on some employer-based thing. There's income changes for more than just employment reasons.
But there have been state buy-in programs that have expanded the income mm-hmm. limits once
yeah.
people are participating in Medicaid to try and address that.
Yeah.
But the state by state, again, it's not across the program.
Right, but it has to be annual. I think that anything less frequent than annual or more frequent than annual is really going to be a problem, because even if your income hasn't changed or nothing's changed, I know in Colorado, I mean, our system throws you off for because the caseworker didn't enter your paperwork. So having anything that's a very frequent is going to be a problem.
Yes.
Hi, Gordy Schiff from Boston. I guess my comment follows on the previous one, which is, you know, I think if this session is anything, it's the most compelling argument why we need a single payer. Instead of getting Medicare for all, we got Medicaid for a few more people, and at a price of it further increase in complexity. I think we're sitting here from the point of view of the how to design these systems, but you, at the other end, at the provider end and at the patient end, it's just going to be more of a nightmare to navigate through this. Your slide about the reforms that we need with the dual eligible
yeah.
and stuff. I mean, I just each line of that, I almost be a thought experiment to put that up and look at how none of this just makes any sense. Of course, it all goes away if you have, you know, a single system for everybody. But it just each of these just further ties us up into knots in this crazy system, increases complexity and transitions. And so I just think we have to not lose sight of this. I think you said you know, we got a victory here, but we really suffered a defeat being kept in these same boxes again. Even the term dual eligible, I just keep thinking about that. It's sort of, what's that mean? You know, we're gonna figure out better ways of coordinating it. It just seems like a very perverted term that we shouldn't even have to be thinking about.
Can I just respond? I mean, here's what we really got out of this, from my perspective. We got a commitment for the first time in this country that everybody, leaving undocumented aliens out, of course, but that everybody ought to be covered. And that's a huge sea change in terms of how we think about healthcare in this country. I'm not going to defend this or take on your position. I mean, there are things. This is not perfect, but it is a commitment that everybody gets access to healthcare, and we've never done that before. So in that way, I see this as a big step forward.
Well, telling people if they buy plans that really don't cover them, these high deductible plans, I wonder.
That's the minimum they have to have. They'll have more available. I mean, I think this has a lot of problems, and many of them haven't been talked about today, and it's not worth going into it. But single payer is never going to happen. I mean, it's ridiculous to even bring that up as an alternative, because it just was never. I mean, we are so far politically from that. You are going to be damn lucky if we have this.
Despite the fact that the majority of the population.
Despite that, you don't have. People who count votes know that it's just not, I mean, it's an easy thing to do, to say we should have had a single payer system. It would be so simple. But if you really want to make something happen, you can't, you have to start thinking of other things, because that will never happen.
Well, things change in politics sometimes in an unexpected way. It will be a big change, but there have been periods in our history in which there have been very big changes that occurred that were unexpected. So that I would like to.
You really have a good possibility of us having at some point, mainly because private insurers have very limited leverage in dealing with what's becoming an increasingly concentrated provider system, that more and more people at some point will be given the option to buy into Medicare. And it'll be a choice. It won't be a single payer, because there'll be other payers. But I could see that happening, mainly because of we're going to have, I mean, there's not a lot in this bill that deals with cost of growth, and we are obviously going to have to deal with that.
But to keep on this issue, thinking that it's unlikely now. Keep on this issue, thinking that it's unlikely that it will happen right now, but thinking that there have been major changes occurring all of a sudden, and which are not easy to predict, I would think that the scientific community, the professional community, should be ready. We should need, for instance, economist analysis of what the payments would be like under single payer. For that matter, I would ask the two local participants, how would your job be if we ever have a single payer? How would that affect your job?
Yes, presumably it would make my job a lot easier, because we spend a lot of our time advocating to get people into the system who don't have access today. People who absolutely have, catastrophic illnesses that don't have any coverage. I'm with John now. I don't think it's politically feasible. That doesn't mean it's not an ideal world, but the question is political feasibility at this point in time. Maybe there's a future for this country where we can get there. But what I see every day, and I think is sort of the crux of this conversation, is the sense of who we are as a country and as a people, and what our sense of obligation is to each other. That's a much larger conversation than healthcare. That's a tax system conversation. That's a design of all of our social programs. That's a core conversation that we are going to grapple with, I think, for a long time. In the meantime, I'd like to see this get off the ground so that the people who haven't had access today actually get into the system, because there are people who don't have anything now, and I want them to have care.
Next question here, then here, then there.
Unintended consequences. I'm from Arizona, and there is another state that also enacted a law this election that we don't have to take this plan. And that's, I don't know what's going to happen to our Medicaid as a result of that, but I think we're having a backlash, and there are more states talking about this. So that doesn't help us. And if we had a single payer system, we wouldn't be dealing with these kinds of issues.
Well, that's your point.
Are there other stakeholders besides HHS and the state Medicaid agencies that should be engaged? I mean, I'm noticing that clearly in Colorado, the Center-in-Law Policy and the Disability Advocacy Community is involved. I'm from Connecticut, and Connecticut has already gotten CMS approval for a low-income adult program that it's been implementing because it's converted its state-administered general assistance population onto Medicaid already. And now the state Medicaid agency is beginning to promulgate some regulations that are of concern to some of the mental health consumer communities. So are there other sort of kind of stakeholder groups that need to be more actively engaged in this, apart from the regulators and the
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to have a broad, particularly the client and advocate in low-income communities, and you have to have a lot of perspectives. The problem is resources of those organizations and those communities to be at all the meetings and to learn all of the different pieces of it is a problem. But it's absolutely essential, and it won't. I can guarantee it will fail if the people that this is supposed to affect, the low-income populations, are not at the table on every step. I also think that encouraging your state to be as transparent as possible, making sure that happens, is an absolute must.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how to participate unless they give you those opportunities.
Transparent in the sense of public meetings, posting,
outreach.
Websites, outreach.
Building stakeholders' involvement in the governmental processes, all that stuff has to happen, I think.
I was just going to say, I'm responsible for implementing this in Illinois for the governor, who was a Democrat who does support single payer, who wants this to work as well as possible. But we need that energy, I think, not focused on a national. At the national level at this point, but I don't care what happens at the national level. I just want to make sure that people who care about this focus their energy in Illinois, and I think that would be true in every state, to make sure that all of these options that the state has, there must be 1,000 of them if you add them all up, that are exercised in the way that gets us as close to the goal as possible of universal coverage. I mean, we're not going to get there because it's undocumented, but we can get farther, we can get we get closer to it, we get more distant to it, depending on how states implement it. So that's, I think, where the battle needs to be over the next 6 to 12 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Suppose we start answering all of these questions, and we get to a point where half of the questions about coverage and eligibility are answered, and we're working on the remainder. Who is going to provide the services? Mm-hmm. Who is going to be recruiting people from whom? What states are going to be in danger of losing people? How are differentials in compensation to providers going to be handled? What are we going to do about facilities in which services will be provided? What are we going to do, especially in rural areas, about the competency of highly skilled professionals, where for many years we have had the question of how many of these procedures does the provider have to do per year to be considered competent at doing them, and how are we going to allocate all this money to get these questions answered?
Elizabeth, would you know your
answers? Make just a couple comments. You asked a lot of questions, and those are very good questions, because there's a huge issue not only on the insurance side of this, which is what we've talked about today, but also on the provider side and the availability of providers to do this. And cite many, many examples, and you cited some here. You know, we lack providers in rural areas. Mental health is basically an urban discipline. So if you're in Chicago or LA, you'll get very good care. If you're in Montana, you won't, basically. There are no child psychiatrists in the whole numbers of states. We know these things. There is some money in this act for training. Wakefield that HRSA has some money for training. We need to work with Mary Wakefield to help her understand you got traditional disciplines, you also have evolving disciplines, you have peer specialists, you have care coordinators, all these types of things. And I think a huge part of this is not us pointing the finger and saying, my God, Mary Wakefield hasn't done this. We have to work with Mary Wakefield to empower her to do some of these things, just like somebody said we have to work with the states. I agree totally with that. One final comment, and then I will stop. The undocumented aliens are not the only population that is a huge concern here. I also represent the counties. This afternoon, the counties have 800,000 people in county jails. 70% of those 800,000 people have various disabilities. The minute they become adjudicated, they lose their Medicaid benefits. It's a huge issue. And all the while they're adjudicated until they come out through release, they are off Medicaid, they have to become re-enrolled and so on. So it isn't only the undocumented aliens we're talking about, we're also talking about the criminal justice population here.
Exactly. All right. Well, we are slightly over time. Maybe there is any other question, or if not, we want to...